I can't think of a more fitting tribute to Marvin than to spend a full day talking about all his papers. And it's been really wonderful to hear the different ways that people knew Marvin. I think almost everybody in this room focuses on central banks. And certainly Marvin focused on central banks. But he didn't just focus on the Fed. And that makes him a little unique relative to many of the people in this room. Because at a time when it wasn't at all fashionable, he was focused on the Japanese central bank. Now, it's hard enough to understand what happens in a central bank. The nomenclature is not straightforward. The institutions are difficult. We have to work through financial intermediaries. Every country has different financial intermediaries. That's particularly true when you get to Japan. There are obvious language barriers, it's a difficult language to learn. The institutional arrangements are completely different. A lot of the other things that are occurring in terms of legal structure are very different. But Marvin actually took the opportunity to say, let's look at what's happening in Japan and not just dismiss it. Let's look at Japan and say, what do we learn from this experience and what can we bring to the United States to think about what could happen? So I'm gonna start by talking about the same paper that was just discussed. The paper was the Overcoming the Zero Bound on Interest Rate Policy. It was in the JMCB. It was a paper prepared for the Woodstock Conference, which was a joint meeting of the Boston Fed and the Board of Governors. And it was actually not only, it was a relatively four-sided conference, but Marvin's contribution was particularly far-sighted. Because at that time, the federal funds rate was 5.2%, and we were raising interest rates. We had not had the recession that was to occur shortly thereafter. We had not had the great financial crisis. And yet Marvin was spending time at that stage asking what happens when interest rates hit zero. What can a central bank do? What should a central bank do? That actually takes a particularly interesting thinker at a time when things aren't happening to say what happens if they go completely wrong, a little bit of what was being suggested by the previous speaker, Andy. So Marvin was really prescient. He was asking about what happened. And when you go back and read that paper, there are things I don't agree with it, but there are two things that I think are really quite impressive. He actually, in many respects, had the playbook of central banks around the world that only occurred 10 years after he wrote the paper. So having that kind of prescience is pretty unusual. So what were the two things that he focused on? One was negative interest rates. So negative interest rates, he thought very carefully about what the institutional details of negative interest rates were at a time when it wasn't pervasive anywhere but Japan. And he thought very hard about what you do about the problem with currency having, not being able to easily go negative. He came up with suggestions that weren't always politically particularly popular, and I know he got into some difficulties with that paper. But he actually took it to a logical extreme to think about how could you actually do that, including kind of understanding the institutional arrangements about how you could do electronic reserves. In some sense, he was in effect talking about a digital currency. He was talking about a tax on currency. But he was really thinking quite broadly about how you actually implement negative interest rates. And he didn't really emphasize the negatives of that, but he did highlight there were negatives. So obviously people that depend on interest income are hurt by such policies. And obviously bank lenders can be stressed by such policies. So he was candid about the possibility that there would be problems with it, but he didn't just rule it out. He actually thought about it and thought about it very deeply. The second thing that he suggested in that same paper was the open market purchases of long-term bonds. So he was thinking about quantitative easing at a time when people really weren't talking about quantitative easing at all. But that really is, particularly for somebody who was a little bit concerned about what that meant between monetary and fiscal policy, that was thinking out of the box even for Marvin. But I would say he did have a caveat that got around this problem with the fiscal policy aspects, which was that the central bank should be indemnified by the Treasury Department in order to do that. Well, that's exactly the arrangement that the Bank of England actually took during the financial crisis. So when you look back at that paper, read through the paper, and say 10 years before we had the financial crisis, the playbook used by almost every central bank was actually laid out in some detail by Marvin's paper. That really is farsighted. And I don't think very many economists at that time, and then if you look at the rest of the conference papers, they were talking about it being very unlikely we hit the zero lower bound. If we hit the zero lower bound, we'll only be there for a quarter or two. And Marvin's saying, no, Japan's been there for quite a while. Why would I believe that? Let's think about what happens if that's not true. So if Marvin were here, what would he be thinking about? What other further issues should we think about? Well, when Marvin was writing his paper, he couldn't have seen the things that we've seen over the last 20 years. So I think one thing that he did think a little bit about in his paper was how much space there is for monetary policy. So he thought that it was quite possible the short rate would go to zero, and so his answer was to buy more long-term securities. During the financial crisis, we started with both the Fed funds rate and the 10-year rate above 5%. So we did get down to zero, but we had fortunately had the capacity to do more at the long end. We're now in a very different situation, as the comments previously stated, where both the Fed funds rate and the 10-year Treasury rate are well below 1%. And that poses a potential problem, because you can easily imagine a situation where we're much like Japan and Europe, and both the short end and the long end are both at zero. So buying 10-year Treasuries when the 10-year Treasury rate is zero doesn't help you very much. A 10-year Treasury would be no different than interest on reserves or buying the T-bills. So the typical quantitative easing probably doesn't work in the way that it did in the last crisis. So what would Marvin be thinking about? Well, actually, he kind of talks about buying other assets as long as you're indemnified. Now, the Federal Reserve Act doesn't allow us to buy a broader set of assets. So we'd have to either change the Federal Reserve Act or you're back to liquidity facilities. The liquidity facilities that you would need to have Treasury indemnification. So I think if Marvin were here, he'd be saying, well, what are other foreign central banks doing? Japan and Europe are in a situation where the entire yield curve is basically at zero or negative in some countries. And so they're buying a wider variety of assets, but they're, for the most part, getting indemnified by their equivalent of the Treasury Department, or they have direct authority to do that. Now, in the second area, I don't know that you necessarily need a digital currency to have negative rates. It probably makes it easier to be not as limited. Marvin certainly explored the possibility of negative rates. I must say this is an area that I diverge a little bit from Marvin, and I wish Marvin were here for me to have the argument with him. And there are a number of reasons, and it's really not tied to what a digital currency solves. So my first concern is that monetary policy works through the banking system. And in countries where negative interest rates have occurred, they have low price-to-book ratios, lower return on assets, and lower leverage ratios. The banks are not in good shape in most countries that have negative interest rates. So if your hope is that the banking system is going to work effectively in a negative interest rate environment, I'm not so sure that's a good assumption. Now, there are many other reasons for why banks in Japan and Europe are not as good shape as in the United States. But I do think negative interest rates have been part of the problem. And I would say in other countries, they provide other support for large banks in a way that I don't think we would be able to in the United States. A second difference with the United States is that they have financial stability authorities in most other developed countries. So an implication of low interest rates for a very long time or negative interest rates for a very long time, particularly if you're waiting until you get to a 2% inflation rate before you start raising rates, is that you have to worry about financial stability implications of very low rates for a very long time. So in other countries, there is some kind of authority that is thinking about financial stability issues, has authority to think about it, but also to do something. That is, do some leverage on households or leverage on firms. There is no authority in the United States to think about financial stability in the way that we have in many other countries, which makes thinking about negative interest rates much more difficult, because one of the biggest collateral problems with negative interest rates that held for too long is you might get excessive leverage in households or firms. Now, there are obviously other ways to get around that. Excessive leverage could get different tax treatment, for example, so you don't necessarily need a central bank to do it. The fiscal authority could be thinking about ways to discourage excess leverage. But in the current environment, I think that's pretty unlikely. So you need to at least address how you think about financial stability. The third thing you have to think about is what happens with retirements and pensions. So the retirement and pension situation in Europe varies country by country. But in many of those countries, the result of the institutional arrangements with their retirement and pension arrangements is that when you get to negative interest rates, people start saving more, not less, which means you don't see more consumption, which makes it very hard for the economy to recover. So that is a problem if one of the ways that you think negative interest rates is going to work is that it's going to encourage people to spend more, but because of the pension arrangements in the country, you actually spend less and save more. So you'd at least have to spend a fair amount of time thinking about pensions, savings, and how people that are already retired are being impacted by that decision. In terms of negative interest rates, it's not clear to me that in Europe, firms behave in a way that generates more investment. There have been a lot of studies that say that investments are not particularly sensitive to interest rates. That doesn't make me particularly optimistic they're going to be particularly sensitive to negative interest rates. And certainly the Japanese and European experience doesn't make me think about it much more optimistically. And the one area that I do think negative interest rates have a big impact on is exchange rates. The problem is everybody can't do it. So if the problem is that globally everybody's having a problem at the same time, everybody can't be beggaring thy neighbor. Somebody has to agree to keep rates high. And I'm not sure we'll be in that world. Now, there are obviously alternatives. Maybe we're asking monetary policy to do too much. So there is fiscal policy. And it's actually surprising we're not having more conferences on fiscal policy now rather than on monetary policy. Because in a very low interest rate world, we should be spending a lot more time thinking about how fiscal policy could do its job. So in the current situation, monetary policy is not going to create a vaccine. Monetary policy is certainly not the solution to public health problems. And if what you're worried about is not only the first problem, but then the second problem is what are the other organizations that are impacted? Well, that's probably directed lending in a way that fiscal policy rather than monetary policy would be the first choice. So we need to spend more time talking about fiscal policy and its responsibilities when we have economic downturns. We should be having more discussion of automatic stabilizers when we have an economic downturn. We should have more discussion about public investment that yield positive returns. Certainly more investment in the CDC would be one obvious example right now. So Marvin was incredibly good at thinking outside the box. This is probably a good time for us to once again start thinking outside the box. We can't just think about the alternatives we did before. We need to think about the alternatives for the future. So I completely agree with Andy's point that we should be thinking about stressing the economy and alternatives. I think we actually do that. We may not talk as publicly about it, but it's an important part of what a central bank does, and we do spend time talking about it. But I think this is a good time for not just the central bank to think about it, but for everybody in this room and other policymakers as well. That's exactly what Marvin would be recommending.